So let's start. Dafchav Dalet Amud Aleph. We'll start again. 2, 4, 6, 8. 10 lines up from the bottom. We'll recap what we've seen, and we'll also address some of the points that we left open this time. So first of all, the first halakha that we've seen was that we were talking about what we're calling the second level erva. Besides the actual nakedness, you are not allowed to say Kriya Shema or any other Divrei Kedusha in the presence of different parts of a woman's body. And the first thing we said was, you're not allowed to recite any Divrei Kedusha in the presence of a tefach that is usually covered, even of your own wife. And on the contrary, the Ramah says that with your own wife, you are not allowed to recite any Divrei Kedusha if a tefach of usually covered part of the body is exposed. With a different woman, if any amount of the body that's usually covered is exposed, this iser applies. I'm sorry? So a child, it depends from what age. Meaning, if you're not talking about a close relative, So it will be the way it will work with a child will be the same thing. From the age of 3, for a girl, you should not, that's what the Mishnah Berurah paskens, you should not be reciting Kriya Shema or saying other Divrei Kedusha in front of a part of the body that's usually covered.
Even if it's your own offspring.
Yeah. Now if it's your own daughter, then from the age of 11. Probably the same. I believe the same. Yeah.
But where a child is usually covered is different from a woman's usually covered.
That's true. The truth is that the Chazon Ish is a little more lenient than the Mishnah Berurah. Where the Mishnah Berurah says a child who's not your relative from the age of 3, the Chazon Ish says he kind of leaves it a little vague, and he says from the age when they start becoming more mature looking. He kind of puts it at 6 or 7. Not so clear. Okay. Now, okay, what we left open last time was, and I want to start by addressing that, we saw Chazal's very sharp statement that this whole discussion is about Kriya Shema, etc., but when it comes to the what are you allowed to look at, if we're talking about a strange woman, so the way Chazal put it was, if you look at the pinky of a woman, meaning of a strange woman, it's like looking at her nakedness. Meaning, it's a very severe issue to look at any part of her body, even the most innocent, normally exposed area. Now what does this mean? So we left this open list, and we kind of left it hanging. This means, we're on Dabchav Dalit Amud Aleph, we're going to start from 10 lines up, Omar Al-Khizda. But I'm just elaborating on last time. It's in one place, but Ramosha says the area of the tefach, meaning if you'll have a strip of half a tefach going across two tefachim, that will also count. In two different places, l'chayr or not. Yeah. So now, the way this works is, clearly means the place can say a person who's looking in order to derive pleasure. What we call, I think the word for that is prurient. A person who's looking in order to derive prurient pleasure. Then we say that it's also to look at a strange woman, meaning a woman who's not your wife or one of your immediate relatives, in any form or fashion. It's also to look at a woman in order to derive pleasure. However, what we'll call if you're walking through the street and you see a woman, you don't necessarily have to turn your face away. Don't gaze, right? If it catches your attention, don't latch on. But also, what I call technical looking, right? Technical looking. Talking to a teller in a bank, right? Do you have to turn your face away? No, you don't have to turn your face away. Now, once again, you have to be careful, because if you say, wow, she's a good looker, you know what? Let's try to make this transaction take a little more time. So the truth is that Chazal Mamish relate to that, and they say that sort of thing, Chazal say about that, if a person chooses the best looking teller, Chazal Mamish say about that sort of thing. lo yinokem midinu shel gehenna. Such a person will not be cleansed from gehenna. So it's a fine line.
You have to make sure it's onto that line.
That's right. So it's a fine line. You have to be careful. Yes, if it's just technical, etc., you're allowed to. But you have to be careful. You have to realize that we're talking about serious things. And it's difficult because the eyes is one of the things, you know, if we talk about how hefker the mouth is, the eyes even more than that. You know, your eyes look around, you know, they see, it's not me doing anything. But it's a serious business. Okay. Now, we'll just add also that the Mishnah Berurah cites, I mean, he's basically just bringing down the bottom line of the different poskim on the matter, that it's a midas chasidus to try to avoid any sort of looking. Meaning if a person, depending on the situation, you have to know how to act. Like sometimes you'll offend a woman or turn her off if you're going to turn your face away, but sometimes there are ways of doing it in an inconspicuous way. You kind of have your eyes, you know, you can be playing with something or something like that. And the truth is that, you know, in today's society, it's like surprising, it sounds like so unfriendly to be talking to a woman with your eyes averted, but the truth is that there are societies, or in earlier times, and there are still people like that today, where on the contrary, a woman will be uncomfortable if you're looking her in the face when you're talking to her. If you need to talk, keep your eyes averted. In the old-fashioned circles, it's still like that. But okay, there's an issue of when it comes to this again. Me'ikar adin, you're not allowed to gaze in order to enjoy. That's the din, and the din is that if it's not for that purpose, if it's technical or whatever it is, it's mutter. That's the din. So that's the starting point. Now you can take it from there and see when the situation enables you or etc. to go a little more lifnim mishur hasadin. But that's already lifnim mishur hasadin. What's that?
About
Oh, that's right. That's right. We had when my son was in first started Gan, he was very, very allergic, very deathly allergic to milk. So we had to hire a special shadow. Besides that, the Gan didn't let any milk into the place. But we hired a special shadow, a special girl to supervise, to be with him all the time. And we got a girl from what they call a Rabaralech. Rabaralech, from the Rabaralech, from the Chassidim, from all the Yerushalmi Chassidim. And this was a girl who. What's that? Yeah. A girl, very, very, very refined girl, who part of what she was going to have to be doing was to be dealing with me. She spoke to my wife, she spoke to me. And she did, but it was very interesting how, you know, I was. Only a couple of years back, and just, this was an 18-year-old girl with a lot of dignity and respectability, made it very clear in a very gentle and able way, you know, exactly what extent, right? Now, I'm not the type who's looking to you know, have an especially warm relationship with the girl I'm employing, but even so, she kept things even to a more bare minimum than I would have thought the bare minimum was. She was like assertive about it. She wouldn't even take things directly from my hand. When I came to pay her the first time, she kind of indicated to the shelf on the side. And that's where I put the money. I had a lot of respect for that. You know, you can approach it two ways. You can say, oh, extreme. Or you could say, look, there are people who are still preserving the old standards, right? How have I, you know, we weren't born in that world, but we can respect it. Okay. We move on. Omar Chizdi. Shoik B'Yishev. Okay, we're just going to move through these things again just to cover the points we didn't cover last time. Well, 10 lines up from the bottom. Omar Chizdi. And that also, and any conversing, she did need to talk to me at different points, but it was always, she kept her eyes averted, which is already a whole different level, right? So, Mamela, I did. There was no need. Okay. Omar Chista. Shoik Be'isha Erva. We'll call it the thigh. The thigh of a woman is an Erva, as we mentioned last time. It's actually machlokes whether this refers to the thigh or the shin, but Mishabura goes with the understanding that this is the thigh. The thigh of a woman is an erva, shenemar, which means that you are not allowed to say any divrei kedusha in the presence of the exposed thigh of a woman, which many of the poskim take to mean even the smallest bit.
We say thigh, mean above the knee?
Above the knee, yeah. Shenema, as it says in the pasuk, gali shoik. How do we know that the thigh is called an erva? It says, when Hashem is, when there's a prophecy about the galus, and the Jewish people are being spoken to as though it's a wayward wife, so it says, gali shoik, you will have to reveal your thigh, avrina harais, and pass through rivers, uksiv. And then it says about that, when you reveal your thigh, tegal ervoseich, your nakedness will be revealed, vegamtera echer poseich, and your shame will be exposed. So we see that, yes, this situation of the thigh being revealed is called the nakedness being revealed. So therefore, yes, it is also to recite Divrei Kedusha when you in view of a woman's thigh, the area above the knee. As we mentioned the other day, perhaps we'll cite it as a chumrah, that it's actually machloikis, whether some say that the shoik is not the thigh, but it's actually the from below the knee to the ankle. This is a machloikis. The Mishabura does rule that it's the area above the knee, and therefore we can consider that the ikar adin, but it's something to take into account. There's certainly room to be machmir, although there's room to be mekel as well when you're dealing with the area under the knee. Now, when I say room to be machmir and room to be mekel, what I mean is, if you're a man, the question is whether you're allowed to make a bracha. With regard to women going around with that area exposed, do women have to wear tights or socks or whatever it is, or is that area allowed to be exposed? That's a little bit more of a complicated shaila, as we mentioned the other day, because even if we'll say that area is not called an erva, there's another thing, that if the minig, if the common practice is to cover a certain area, it must be covered even if it's not an erva meikar adin.
And does it become an erva in that case?
Yes, for that area, it doesn't become an erva permanently, but in a place where the minig is to cover a certain part of the body, let's say you'll have a place where women go with gloves, so the hand will be an erva for that place.
Perhaps if we get these, let's say, for example, more extreme version, the burqa ladies, get these, someone beat them the other day. If you start having a community en masse dressed into the point you're going to see their eyes, could that mean that the face could be erva in certain societies?
If it would become the widespread practice of the whole area. That's not happening so fast.
What's that? What's covering?
Oh, so that's why it is much as we're considering the area under the knee, an area that has to be covered. The stockings or tights should certainly be of a certain minimal thickness. Exactly what, I can't tell you. Look in the Sfarim.
But above the knee, doesn't matter. Even if it's a society which is not the most moral.
Above the knee is erva absolute. In a society where they're not makbid on it, the din is move away. That's what it says about the area above the knee, the area above the elbows. These don't depend on it. Things that are, what we'll say, absolute covered areas are absolute. Above the elbows, above the knee, is absolute. Now, the area from the knee to the ankle, again, it's questionable, and it's hard to determine what you'll call the minhag olam today. As we said today, certainly, again, if we're going by the general minhag olam is, we don't want to discuss too much. The navel is also up for question, right? But if we're talking about, in order to determine what the minhag olam is, you have to determine who qualifies. That has to be people who are keeping halacha to a certain extent. Once again, if we're going by people who keep halacha to a certain extent, what will the majority be? I don't know.
You just added above the elbow.
Above the elbow is absolute. That doesn't depend on minute.
Is that the serious ones, like they stick to above the knee, but they wish. T-shirts,
I believe that the more serious cover the elbow as well. As far as those who don't, that's for them to explain, not for me to explain. I have no need or inclination to try to justify it.
Why is that a kofa?
What's that?
I was thinking, like, why are you a kofa to the upper leg? It's obvious. leg.
Why do you need a makor for the upper leg?
Yeah, it's obvious, right? But the upper is not so obvious.
Well, it's not the okay. The truth is that the place can is there. The mafreshim is. Not Shafar can ask a more basic question. Once we said that a tefach of covered areas of erva, why do we have to specify the shoik? Right, that's basically what you're asking. So the place can answer that in a couple of ways. Either the answer is, like we said before, we're specifying the shoik to say that yes, other areas it might take a tefach to turn it into an erva. The shoik, the thigh, any amount is an erva. That's what some say. Others say that you might have thought, and this is interesting, it sounds a little technical, but this has a lot of significance. The Rashba says, in the name of the Raiva, that the reason that we specify the leg is that you might have thought that since the derech by men is not to be particular about keeping it covered, since by men people don't necessarily have it covered, so you might think that it's not an erva for women either, and therefore we have to stress that it is. What's that? The shaykh. What's that?
I said they wear shorts. They wear shorts
tonight. Oh, so that's a good question. Did they wear shorts 900 years ago? I don't think so. That's why I think that this Rashba is pretty clearly understanding shaykh to mean the area below them. That's how I understand. Well, if he's saying it's an area that men don't care about, right? That men don't keep covered. I don't think it's so plausible that he's referring to the area above the knee. So I took that as an indication that the Rashba does understand that it's the area under the knee. Gone something even more, again, these are just my understandings. The Ra'a answered that you might think that since it's an area that inevitably will sometimes get uncovered, so it's not an erva. So therefore the Gemara had to stress that it is. Does that mean the area above the knee? Which part of the leg inevitably will get uncovered? Yeah, you certainly know. People are walking around with robes. It's going to bounce up a little bit. Is it going to bounce to above the knee?
No,
I don't know. What's that?
So he sits down.
Inevitably? It seems indicative that both of these Rishonim are understanding the Sheikh is referring to the area under the knee. I don't know. It's arguable. But we'll call this inferences. If not proofs, we'll call them inferences. Questionable. But above the knee, there's nothing to talk about. If you're facing, okay. Let's answer that question now, and we're going to address it more length as we go on. What happens when you are facing, right? You're in the street, and the women in the street are dressed the way women dress in the street, and you want to say a bra. The women in shorts or whatever it is. So when it comes to a real erva, the din is that you have to turn your body away, you have to turn your head away. Closing your eyes is not enough.
You
can't be facing it. Actual nakedness. No, actual nakedness. Now all these other areas covered parts of the body is machlokes haposkim, how it works. Do you have to actually turn your head away, or is it enough to close your eyes? So the Mishnah says better to turn your head away, but if it's difficult or whatever it is, closing the eyes will suffice.
So there's more science about how you realize
you're closing your eyes. No. It's because the din of erva is that it shouldn't be in front of you, right? So therefore, you're supposed to turn your face away. But again, these covered parts of the body is what we're calling second rate erva. The first rate erva, the real deraisa, is the mamish, the basic nakedness. All these other parts of the body is what we're calling second rate erva. And therefore, by second rate erva, it's questionable whether you have to go that far, if it's enough to close the eyes. So as we said, better to actually turn your head away. If it's a tough situation, closing the eyes will suffice. Okay. Omar Shmuel. Shmuel said, and here's also where we left a few open ends. Koil bi'isha erva. A woman's voice is an erva, which again the place can basically take to mean singing. Shenema, as it says in the pasuk, ki koilech orev umarech nova. Because your voice is sweet and your appearance is beautiful. So again, as we noted the other day, this is actually a pasuk of Hashem. talking to the Jewish people. The romance of Shir HaShirim, if we'll call it that. But from here we infer that yes, since you see that the woman is being, right, when the lover is describing the voice, you see that the voice is one of those elements that attracts the other gender. So therefore, yes, we infer from here that the voice of a woman is also in heaven. A couple of questions were brought up here. By the way, I'll just note that Rav Tzedek says that, let's note, it's very interesting that we're deriving from here, from the effect that our voice has on Hashem, we're likening that to the erva of a woman singing. Which means that, yeah, we're comparing the effect that a woman singing has on a man to the effect that our voice has on Hashem. In Kiviyachol, it mamish gets Hashem going. It gets him very enthused when he hears the voice of a Jew speaking to him. Our deep gravelly masculine voices, which, right, yes, you open your voice and you talk it to Hashem. Hashem is mamish affected and enthused by it. The way the Chazon Ish puts it is that when a Jew opens his voice in tefillah to Hashem, turning to Hashem, appealing to Hashem, in Hashem's ears, kiviyachol, okay, it's like a harp.
You can interpret this as singing, a woman singing.
Right.
So is it our singing tefillah?
No, it's not even that. No, even the talking of tefillah is the zemer in the ears of Hashem. The singing is of Hashem. The way the Chazon Ish puts it is, it's like Hashem hears a beautiful harp starting to play when you open your mouth to daven to. Yes, with your deep, gruff voice. That's what you're doing to Hashem. What's that? Oh, yeah.
Yeah, they're not listening to a woman sing, so the man shouldn't be turned off.
What's that?
Yeah, they're not listening to a woman sing, so the man shouldn't be turned off. Okay. So, maybe kind of
Yeah, well, any unmarried woman above the age of 12 is most likely to be an Ida. Once a woman has her first period, she's an Ida until she goes to the mikveh. Now, girls have their first period at the age of 12, they go to the mikveh before they get married. Once a girl has her first period, she's going to be an Ida now for the next 8 years or so. So yes, that's right. The Me'ikar Adin, you're allowed to hear the voice of an unmarried woman singing, except that basically all unmarried women are nidas. Okay, so here also a couple of questions raised the other day which I want to address. I researched some of the questions. First of all, the point that you made, when you hear the girls singing in school or something like that, and you mentioned that you heard a heter when there's a bunch of women singing together. So I checked that out. There is such a heter cited, which seems to have originated in Germany by Rabbi Shimshon Rafael Hirsch and Rabbi Israel Hildesheim, who said we have to qualify this heter, but we're going to call it a lenient factor. Meaning it's more lenient when you're hearing a group of women singing together than one particular woman, because hearing one particular woman arouses feelings for that particular woman. When you're hearing a bunch of women together, it's hard, you don't get feelings aroused for any particular one. However, there are a couple of qualifications that have to be drawn here, because they base it on the principle of Trei Koli La Mishtah, which means that, let's say, you're hearing Kriyas HaTorah in Shul and two Bali Koyra are reading together, Halacha says you didn't hear either of them, because you can't make out, the voices are confusing, you can't make out any. So therefore, when you're hearing two voices simultaneously, it's called that you're not really hearing either. And therefore they say the same thing goes for hearing a bunch of women singing together. You're not really hearing a woman's voice. But there's a big problem with this, which really ends up in a big qualification of this Halacha. The Gemara there says that Halo, for example, or Megillah, this law doesn't apply for. Because when you have a particular interest in hearing something, you'll hear it even if there's two voices together. That's what the Gemara said. Now, inasmuch as a woman's voice is attractive, the men will exert themselves to hear. What's that? Well, put it this way, not as interested as the Megillah. The Megillah is considered especially exciting. Right? So when something is especially exciting, you're going to make a point of hearing it also. This is a question that many of the Poskim after these two great authorities asked. Well, they said a couple of things. So they said that first of all, it probably applies only when you cannot see the women, that's number one. Number two, when you don't know who the women are, because if you know who the women are and you can make out the voice of one of them, it will still be a problem. So that those are the two main qualifications. You can't see the women, and that you don't know who they are. That then Ithaka makes it more lenient, this issue. Makes it more lenient. Okay. Yeah. Yeah. Because the concept of trade color applies to two.
Since we're on the topic of, does this make it lenient? If one voice is on a recording and you don't know whose voice it is, you never heard that voice before, or you can put a face to it.
Ah, so this is what was brought up here. How does it work with the recording when you don't know who it is? So I'm going to say that likely that yes. However, meaning that, put it this way, we'll call it a lenient factor. I wouldn't say that lechatchila you can go do it. I'd buy a tape of, but it's likely to be more lenient. How more lenient? Does it make it mamish mutter, or is it more bishas hadchak? It's more lenient.
When you're dealing,
what's that?
You don't have to get off the bus.
Right. And not only that, if you need to make a bracha on the bus, we already mentioned. If you need to make a bracha on the bus, and there's music playing with a woman singing, in general, the place can say that when it comes to this issue per se of a woman singing, since it's in many situations, it's just hard to get away from it. And here I'm not just talking hard times. This is already the place can said 500 years ago that it was apparently, you just had it around in the streets. So you just kind of try to tune them out, and that's all. However, one important qualification that the place can throw in here, Moshe Gross throws this, and he says you have to remember that at the end of the day, there's a separate halacha that lemaisa, anything that turns you on in reality is a problem in and of itself. So don't go utilizing these heterim if lemaisa turns you on. If it turns you on, then it's clearly awesome. He cites the halacha that says you're not even allowed to look at the clothing of a woman if it's going to turn you on. They also say clothing of a woman that you know, and when your mamish don't associate it with any woman, so nah. But okay, so again, we will say that these are factors of leniency that you can take into consideration when you're in more difficult situations, if it's a group of women together, if it's a voice of a woman that you don't know who she is, etc. These are factors for leniency. Okay. Omar Abshashis. I move on to another class. Seyor Beisha Erva. The hair of a woman is an erva. Shenema, because here also we find, right, the lover in Shir HaShirin is noting this as well. Sarech ke'eder ho'izim. Your flowing hair is like a flock of goats, spilling down the hill. So yes, the uncovered hair of a woman is similarly an erva. Now this of course has to be qualified somewhat, because what about all the unmarried women? So here also the place can go with
the pasuk itself.
Meaning what? Goats are not all that beautiful?
Goats are your wives.
What's that?
Goats are your wives.
Well, if you look at the analogies in the psukim, a lot of them sound strange. Right? It says that your temple looks like a chunk of pomegranate. Try that. Right? No, but the point is that it has, the point is not that, oh wow, your hair reminds me of goats. that would not be much of a compliment. But the point is that the beauty in observing these phenomena of nature are reminiscent of what your hair is. Like when you see, I don't know if you ever see, not when you see like a hole, sometimes you see in the mountains right out here in Bet, out of Bet. We go there sometimes on Chol HaMoed, there's Bedouins there with sheep. There's a whole area, it's a nice little area there. And sometimes when you see the mamish, the flocks coming down, it's mamish, like it's spilling over the hilltop. Mamish looks like there's a current, it's like a waterfall. And it's a sight to behold. It's something that, it's how do you say in English, miragesh, it's moving, right? It's a certain beautiful aspect of nature. That's what he's saying. These things arouse in me these feelings. Sometimes a person can almost feel very enthused by seeing some of these beautiful sights of nature. Okay. Now, what's that?
Unmarried
women. So unmarried women. So here also the place can say that certainly this goes with the issue of what the custom is. But here it gets a little more tricky because we're distinguishing within one area. You have the unmarried women go with their hair uncovered, the married women go with their hair covered. And so we say that, okay, so therefore, as far as unmarried women go, it's not called an erva because that's the custom. And as far as married women go, it is an erva because married women should be covering their hair. So the truth is that we might say that no, actually, as far as custom goes, hair is not such a problem because you see goyim around with uncovered hair, and the place can say, well, I said that's not a problem either, since you know, as long as she's covered decently, the fact that she's a married woman and she has her hair uncovered, since that's the derech of how goyim go, it's the same as unmarried women who have their hair uncovered. By Jewish married women, the issue is that even if we'll say that you're used to it, it'll be kind of like the same as what we said before. Let's say in our society, women go with sleeveless shirts and shorts. That does not make things that are inherently usher to be showing, they remain problematic. So therefore, when it comes to a married woman whose hair should be covered, the fact that the minig hamakon is that women go with uncovered hair doesn't help. So therefore, for unmarried women and even for goyisha women, as long as the rest of them is kind of basically covered, the hair is not a problem. But yes, for married women it is.
But let's say 67 years ago in Europe, were women covering their hair?
Unfortunately, many did not. It was a widespread breach.
Even in
Hamish's
circles,
it was a widespread breach. Many women did not cover their hair. We're going to get to that in a minute. What were you going to say?
Is this sort of second degree error?
What's that? Yeah. Yeah. In this sense. Yeah. Not the iser to expose the hair is an iser d'oraisa. But as far as saying divrei kedusha, opposite it, what's that?
It
says erva about all these things.
Turn my
what's that? It's like all the other things that we saw in Machlokes. Actual nakedness is the erva d'oraisa, and that you clearly have to turn your head. All these other things, it's better to turn your head, but if you can't, it's enough to close your eyes. Now, what's that? To recite divrei kedusha opposite actual nakedness.
What is
the
reason?
What's that?
It's something
that
strikes me sometimes very funny. We see a woman with her hair is covered, and she's walking around with green nails or blue nails or something. It just doesn't seem to.
It doesn't. It's not that it doesn't seem to fit. It doesn't fit. It doesn't fit. And yeah, we'll give a little bit more of a general perspective on this. But regarding your question, yeah. Okay, in Europe it was Baruch Hashem, in that sense today the Olam is more makvi, but in Europe it was a very widespread epidemic that women did not cover their hair.
In America too.
Oh, in America, yeah, that goes without saying. I meant Europe as opposed to the Middle East, meaning as opposed to the Arabic countries where the Sephardim were. As far as the best of my knowledge, the epidemic didn't spread there. You'll have to, is that so?
I can't say that I know that.
What's that? Meaning that it's not so?
I
you don't know.
I
don't know.
My mother's generation didn't cover
their hair. They didn't. So it was even
the generation there. Before that,
they did. Whatever it is, it was a widespread phenomenon, which was dependent which areas, but it was a widespread phenomenon. And here it became a question. So how do we view it? The women are doing the wrong thing. Period. Now, what happens as far as saying brachas goes? So that was a machloikis. The Maisel Mishabura rules that even in an area where the women, he always stresses, whenever he talks, even in an area where the women go like this, he always stresses, kiderech haprutzos, right? But he says that it remains aser. There were others who were matir. The Aruch HaShulchan was matir, the Ben Yishchai was matir. So again, these women are doing the wrong thing. The Aruch HaShulchan is a whole preface. We should be yelling and screaming about it. But as far as saying brachas goes, he says, since Lamaisa, everybody has their hair uncovered, it's okay. So, Lamaisa, but again, Mishnah Berurah says it's not.
It's okay to do what?
To say a bracha in the presence of uncovered hair.
What's it say, like,
what's that? The rule is that once a woman has been married, she should be covering her hair. And the, also, this is not really relevant nowadays. Once a, even a virgin who is arusa should be covering her hair as well. But today, that's an issue of 10 minutes. It's not.
Are there any leniencies though for married women that don't want to wear head covering? That's right, a divorced woman or
a divorced woman or divorced woman or a widow does not want to wear a head covering. It's more lenient than a married woman. It's aser. It's more lenient. Meaning the way the Mishaburo puts it is, a married woman doesn't want to cover her hair, Bezdin should force her. A divorced woman or a widow cannot be forced. That's why Mishaburo puts it.
Why shouldn't she be like a
single widow? I don't know. I don't know what the pshat of that is. I don't
the Arusa then under the chuppah see brothers?
Oh, so that's not so clear. That's not so clear. It seems that there are different mahalkim in that. There are meticulous who do. What's that? Well, sometimes it's transparent, right? There are those who have the meaning to wear a sheitel, to wear a wig by the chasana. Others, I don't know. I would assume that there's basis for it. But I don't know. The truth is that the ikar din does go by cohabitation. Once a woman had relations. Okay. Right. That's in as much as the permissibility for women to go around that way. But in as much as the issue of making a bracha, they say, since Lamaisa that's the derech, people are used to it. Rav Moshe. Yeah, we just forgot the bracha. Yeah. Okay. Okay, I just want to put this in the general perspective. This is mamish the point you just raised before, the green nail polish with the head covering. So you have to understand what the whole issue here is. The whole issue here is the way the Shulchan Aruch puts it is, again, the problem is like we said before, we talked about tolerance the other day, right? We gave one definition of tolerance, meaning if I want to be lax about halacha, I have to be understanding of people who are even more lax. But tolerance in its social context certainly does not mean that you respect other people's more stringent standards. On the contrary, the more tolerant you are, the more you know to put down chumras. But there's another aspect of tolerance, and that is something might have been usher, known to be usher for many years, but once people start doing it, you can't talk about that anymore. Right? Let's say this. I remember I was once by a simcha. The fellow was speaking, it was Pashas Kairach. Right? You remember the story of Oyin ben Peles' wife? Oyin ben Peles' wife, she wanted to save her husband from the machloikis. When Kairach and his gang came to pick Oyin ben Peles up, what'd she do? She sat outside her tent with her hair uncovered, and that sent them running, right? So I was at a simcha where someone wanted to tell this story in the Dvar Torah. The problem is that half the women in the lady section didn't have their hair covered. But he needed to tell the story. So what did he do? So he said, he told the story, and he said, so Oyin ben Peles' wife sat outside in a way that Jewish women didn't used to sit at that time. That was all. There you go. That's tolerant, right? Something might have been the standard for many years, for 2,000 years. Once people start doing that today, you can't talk about it anymore. Because, once again, tolerance is a supreme value. Comes before the age-old values of the Torah. But what's important to stress, especially when we're talking about these things, is that there's going to be a discrepancy between what people today will call normal and what the real standards of the Torah are. If we're actually going to go work backwards and start really trying to analyze it, it'll sound extreme. But if we say, for example, what did Goyisha women look like 200 years ago? Goyisha women, right? I'll just give one simple example of something that today we're talking in the most from circles, right? In 200 years ago, Goyisha women, girls, did not go with loose hair beyond their shoulders, right? Today, we're talking about it's the most normal thing in the world, right? So, when we talk extreme, the question is, how do you decide something is extreme, right? If 200 years ago it was normal among Goyim, but today, since we drifted even more, it becomes extreme. Let's say, where's the start? Is the starting point the Torah standards, and then we say, well, then today's standards are extreme? Or the starting point, what's called normal today, and then we say, well, what you're claiming the Torah standards are extreme. The lashon of the Shulchan Aruch is, when it comes to these things, it's tzorich li'srachik min anoshim me'oid me'oid. You don't see this lashon of the Shulchan Aruch. One must distance himself from women me'oid me'oid, very, very much. I don't know if you find anywhere else in the Shulchan Aruch me'oid me'oid. I don't know. But the expected standards that the Torah has in how careful we are about these things reflect a very, very, very fundamental point in just understanding who we are. The Torah expects us to live on a plane, in a place that is completely unrealistic. Right? The Torah's expectations of decency of the Jewish people is something that, yes, people in the outside world, it just can't be. It can't be that there's a whole tzibur that's really keeping to these things today. Right? I think I've told this story a few times. I'll tell it again. I was once in a taxi in Brooklyn, a Muslim taxi driver, Indian Muslim, and we started talking about, we started schmoozing. We spoke in learning. We spoke about our religions. He spoke about Islam, and I spoke about Judaism. And he pointed out what we have in common is that both of our religions forbid involvement with women, right? Other than your wife. And he looked at me and he said, but you know, okay, in today's times, it's just not kind of like not again anymore. So I was 19 at the time, wasn't married. So I told him, why? I never touched a woman outside of my immediate family. So he looked at me just like, who do you think you're kidding? Don't tell me stories. But what is the pshat? He's right. The truth is, he's right. It's impossible in today's day and age. The Torah is capable of training us to the impossible. You have to realize that. Avigdor Miller said that one time in the shul they used to have they had the activists who would work on the political agendas in the city in general, and a lot of times they had common agendas with the Catholics because the Catholics also had a more conservative agenda, and there would sometimes be meetings to discuss different political things. They used to meet sometimes in the basement of the shul. Sometimes there was a few of the shul staff was meeting with the head of one of the big Catholic kahilas. And they used to get into this friendly theological jousting. Right? So, this fellow said, you Jews are so into, your morals and your standards. We can do just as well as any of you. He pulled out of his pocket and said, look what our church has. He opens up his wallet and he shows us a picture of five girls. Picture of five girls, he said, this is, we have in our church a chastity club. A chastity club. Five girls who are committed to not have relations until they get married. This is what the achievement of this big Catholic kahila. This is what they were able to show. So Rabbi Miller was saying that, he was relating that in his shir, and he said, there you see what the Jewish people are. In our Beis Yankivs, right, in the high schools, is anybody talking about chastity clubs? We're talking about Shmiras Haloshin clubs, and we have 700 girls enrolled. Is anybody talking about chastity? Is it even a subject? In today's day and age, we have to step back and appreciate the greatness of what we're doing. We're doing things that are impossible. We're doing things that really can't be. Right? And where does that come from? It comes from the fact that, yes, we are keenly aware of what a man is and what a woman is and what a woman does to a man, right? And therefore we take extreme measures. So often you hear people say, Goyim or irreligious, come on, you're serious, you folks are so disgusting that like you can't shake a woman's hand, otherwise you're going to start, right? And what's our answer to this? Yes, we're that disgusting. The rest of the world is not, the rest of the world can handle it, and look at the rest of the world, right? Look at what's going on out there. Yes, because we are up front, probably the most honest about, yes, what we're worried about, what might happen to us. That's why we are where we are. And that's really what's behind all these halachas and tzniyos. But it's impossible to really believe you'll be able to retain these things if women are walking around the street trying to poke eyes out. Right? So if a woman basically says, okay, what's the halacha? Now I'm going to do anything else within the halacha, right? We said feet are allowed to be exposed, so I'll put on your green nail polish, right? So understand what you're trying to do. We're trying to bring the Jewish people to be living on a higher plane, on a plane above reality, right? Connect to that. Don't try to be forcing your way back down into the world while still saying, but yeah, I'm getting away with keeping halacha. Appreciate that. Yes. In the street, we want men not to be interested in what the women look like, and the women have to come out, go outside looking boring. That's right. Can you look boring if this is going to work? That's the only way it works. Yes, we have to be honest. We're men, and like Chofetz Chaim said, again, people say, oh, you really can't handle that. Chofetz Chaim was once at a meeting with Rabbanim in one of these convention halls. He was meeting with a lot of Rabbanim. Chofetz Chaim was, I don't know, in his deep 80s or something. And a girl walked through. She was a helper there or something. She had her sleeves above the elbows. And the Chofetz Chaim, the saintly Chofetz Chaim, at the age of 85, he closed his eyes and he said to the people around him, what does she think, that we don't have flesh eyes? I would say, come on, you know, you can't rise above it. We rise above it by avoiding it. That's how we rise above it. The rest of the world is strong enough, they can handle it, and look at them. Right? So that's tzniyus. In these areas is really where the greatness of the Jewish people, way head and shoulders way above the rest, can manifest if we only wanted to. We have to realize that yes, it's these are concepts and standards that are abnormal in today's society. Okay, we move on. I'll just one more. I can't resist, but this is kind of connected, really revolving around the same subject. There was a woman who my wife knows. She had just given birth. After a woman gives birth, she's usher to her husband. She was in the hospital together with an irreligious roommate. And her husband came in, the religious woman, and he sat down on the chair, and you know, they were conversing. There was no touching, there was no anything. Okay. And then he left. Meanwhile, the other woman's husband came in, and he was on the bed all over her. You know, they were okay. So when the two husbands left, the religious woman turned to the religious one, and she said, "That's how your husband treats you after you had a baby, right? Just that distance, that coolness." So she just blurted out of her mouth, without much thinking, she said, "Yeah, but I can rest assured that I know where my husband is when he's not in the hospital." That was what she said. Then the other woman burst into tears. She burst into tears. And she didn't say anything. She just cried for a little while. And then she said, "Tell me a little more about it." She said they spoke throughout the night, straight through the night. And then it was just, because she was so, it hit home. This point hit home. Right? And the next morning, when the two husbands came again, this other woman now told her husband, wait, sit down on the chair there, let's talk. Okay, move on. Amar Rabbi Chanina, Ani Ra'isi Es Rebbe, I saw Rebbe Shetala Tfilov. I saw him hang his tefillin. He hung him from a hook. So the Gemara says, Meisavei, is that so? We challenge that. Hatoyle Tfilov. If a person hangs his tefillin, yitalu lo chayot, his life will be suspended. And if you put your tefillin in a precarious manner, your life will be precarious. Dor shechamur leisamu, those who know how to expound psukim, they said, v'hoyu chayecha tluim l'chomi neged, one of the curses of the Torah is, your life will be suspended, you'll see it dangling in front of you. Zehatele tefillah, that's referring to a person who dangles his tefillin. If you dangle your tefillin, your life will dangle. So how could Rebbe do that? What's that? He hung them, yeah. He hung them up. So the Gemara says, Let's see. Let's see. So the Gemara says, like Kash, it's not a contradiction. It depends what you're hanging. If you're hanging the straps, meaning, let's say you put the box on a shelf and the straps are hanging down, that's okay. Habiktitza. But if you have the box hanging down, that's no good. V'imayisim. Or alternatively, no. Loishna ritzua v'loishna k'titza asu. Makes no difference if it's the strap or the box. Neither part of the tefillin is allowed to be hanging. V'chitala Rebbe. And how did Rebbe hang his tefillin? Bekista tala. He hung it in the bag. To hang tefillin in the bag is okay. Meaning to hang the bag. But to actually hang a part of the tefillin itself, that not. I mean, if the tefillin are rest, the tefillin should be resting on something. If they're resting in the bag, that's fine. Not dangling in the air. Now, what about when you're putting your tefillin on? So that's what you just asked. Well, you talked about the people who hold the strap with the box hanging down, but it's the other way around, right? When you take off the, so we already discussed, when you take the strap off the box to put your tefillin on, we already discussed that you shouldn't have it on the floor. But if I'm going to come and say now that you shouldn't have it hanging, it's going to become very complicated to put tefillin on, right? So, what's that? And then put your head under the table. So the Mishmura says, Lamaisa, that the hanging that you're doing in order to put it on is not an issue. Right? It's part of the putting on. I'll note though that there were those who were makbid about that, but that's already midas chasidus. The Pratzkol Levinstein was very careful never to have it hanging, the bias itself. He put it, hold it in his hand the whole time, put it on his head. But what's the din? The din is that, yes, you're not allowed to have your tefillin hanging in any way, but when you're putting it on, in the part of the process of putting it on, it's not a problem to have the straps or the box hanging. And the strap is called. That's its tzura of the hanochah. That's the way it's meant to be worn. No. So that's a zilzul, because don't have it dangling. It should be well rested, resting securely. What's that? No. The way you wear it is the way you wear it. That's the way it's meant to be worn.
Right.
Oh, okay. Right. That's a. You'll have them on the floor. Well, yeah, that depends on you. You have to figure out your mitzvahs, your reality. Right. So the Gemara says, "Well, what did Rabbi do? He hung it in the bag." So the Gemara says, "E hachi ma'ala memra. If that's what he did, then what's the chiddush? Why are we, you know, this Talmud?" Rabbi Chanina made a point of saying, "Oh, you know, Rabbi hung his tefillin. He hung it in the bag. What's that? The bag is a tashmish kedusha, but it's not kedusha itself. Oh, you're saying that it's a chiddush that's not called that disrespectful.
Yeah,
I hear. But the Gemara says another chiddush. Ma'u detema. You might think, you know, this might be along the lines of what you're saying." No, it might be the same as a Sefer Torah. Sefer Torah is not allowed to be hung even in an ark. The din is that you're not allowed to have an Aron Kodesh even suspended in the air. Wherever the Sefer Torah is, has to be firmly placed on the ground. So therefore, for example, you cannot have an Aron Kodesh nailed into the wall, suspended off the ground. So you might say that the same goes for tefillin. So Kamash Malan, therefore we tell you that no, meaning that it's true. It's true. Your point is a good point. At a certain level, it's more respectful to have something well placed than hanging. Yet, and therefore the tefillin themselves also should not be hanging. Yet it's not quite the same as the Sefer Torah. The Sefer Torah, the whole business has to be well placed on the ground. The tefillin, it's not quite like that. It's a step down. The bag can be hanging. The tefillin themselves cannot, the bag can be hanging. So that's tucking it in. An Aron Kodesh is not allowed to be nailed into the wall. Oh. So what is permitted, though, is when the Sefer Torah when the Aron is actually built into the wall. That's how it is in the Yeshiva in Beryanka, for example. When it's actually built into the wall, that's okay. But to just have a separate box nailed into the wall, off the ground, is actually usur for an Aron Kodesh. Yeah. Okay.
I
I've seen an iron kodesh inside the door, but there, like you cut a hole and it's sitting on that middle piece. That would be okay?
Yeah, if it's a nice on a shelf that's resting on the wall, it's okay. Okay, we'll stop here.